mass organisations of the working class change. And they can even change into the opposite. In the case of the CFDT, it was a Catholic union set up to combat the communists, support of the Vatican, the right wing, and so on. By 1968, it had changed. It was mainly, it's true, its main base was among the teachers, the white-collar workers, the bank employers, some light industry, and so on and so forth. But in 1968, the CFDT was to the left of the CG, the communist CG, far to the left. The main slogan was what they say, that's autogestion, workers' control, in effect, that's what they meant. Workers' control was the main idea. And then there was a smaller union still. I think they had about 750,000 members in CFDT. And then there was a small union called the Force Ouvrière, which was actually set up by the CIA to combat communism in France. It's a smaller union. But the decisive unions in France was the CGT and the CFDT. But you see, if you add up all the unions, this is an interesting point. If you add up all the union membership in France at that time, in Britain incidentally, this might come as a surprise to you, the British workers were very well organized. The mass of the British workers, I think it was 13 million workers were in the trade union. Trade unions in Britain, and there was just one movement, the TUC. And they were very militant. You see, people forgot that. The British workers were the most militant in Europe at that time. More militant than the French, apparently. But in France, if you add up all the men, you won't come to more than about 3.5 million members at most. Only 3.5 million. Yes, but 10 million workers struck and occupied the factories in France. Like that. The CGT leaders and the other trade union leaders called the general assembly, but it was supposed to be a one day and a demonstration. I think there was 1 million workers came on that demonstration. The mainly workers. In a very militant mood. 1 million people hit the streets of Paris, and that was it. That was it. It was like an enormous boulder, an enormous heavy rock that has fallen into a lake, which is apparently tranquil. It makes waves, and the waves immediately spread throughout France, to every region. Every factory, every town, every city, every village was affected. Every section of the population was affected. Just work that out. Less than 4 million workers were organized in unions. So you could say, if you were an academic Marxist, you might say, well, look what a low level of consciousness. They can't even be bothered to join a union in France. You see? Yes. But in the critical moment, 10 million workers joined the general strike, and 10 million workers occupied the factories and workplaces throughout France. Immediately. In most cases, in the overwhelming majority, they weren't even called out on strike. They just went on strike anyway. They just saw it was happening. They turned on the television. That's the advantage. One of the few advantages of television. You can see what's happening. They struck. They occupied the factory. The Renault workers occupied. It was a fantastic strike. I think there were about 5,000 workers in the Flint's factory, wasn't there? I think there's about 5,000 just in one factory. Can you imagine 5,000 workers seizing the factory? And that happened all over France. All spontaneously. The Citroën plant was not organized, as far as I remember. I think it was not organized. It was run like a police state. These nice, democratic capitalists who believe in democracy and so on. It was run like a police state. You were not allowed to join a union. They had thugs patrolling the factory day and night. The workers had to carry an identification document. And most of them were Algerians or Yugoslavs, or Spanish, or Portuguese. People in Spain forgot that they had to work as immigrants years ago. Unfortunately, many of them, they've forgotten this. They used to be downtrodden immigrants, very badly treated too, in countries like France. So they organized. I mean, they didn't have an idea. They brushed all this nonsense to one side and they organized the fact. They were the boss. And that happened not just in every factory. In the villages, the peasants started to move. In Nantes was a very militant area. The peasants around, and the French peasant is not a particularly revolutionary person, rather, plus bien conservé, plus bien plutôt gaulliste. Yeah, at that time, the French peasant, the peasants. They distributed free food to the strikers. In many areas, you had workers' control was set up to run towns. Who says the working class cannot run society? They began to run society. Workers' committees were set up of workers, peasants, housewives, and so on, to control the food prices. Some shops had to publish a notice outside that our products, are the prices of these products are controlled by the committee, and that we're selling, for example, potatoes instead of 70 centimes. Might sound a bit ridiculous. Now, 70 centimes, we were saying it at 10 centimes. I've forgotten the prices. I think I put them in the article. At that time, you couldn't move in France without the permission of the workers. The workers, in effect, were in. The truth of the matter is that power was in the hands of the French workers. Power was in the hands of the French workers, but they didn't know they had the power. And by the way, not just the workers, because the argument is, but what about the middle class? Well, what about the middle class? The middle class also were fed up of the Gaullist government and its repressive laws and so on and so forth, and the economic exploitation. The peasants were conservative, but they were supporting the strikers in many areas to the extent of giving away free food. But not just the peasants. I can speak from personal experience. Because as Nicolas said, I went to 68 in France representing a militant tendency, representing our tendency, with another Scottish comrade. He had an old banger, an old car, and we set out for France. It was a bit of an adventure because, of course, with the general, this chap, I don't know, plus because he was Scottish, I don't know, but he hadn't put enough petrol in the car. Forgot to pay for the petrol. But, of course, in France, there was a slight problem with petrol because being a general strike, the movement of these goods were very restricted and so on. So there wasn't that. Most of the garages didn't have any petrol, and those that had, there were huge queues. So we were thinking, for God's sake, we're never even going to get to see the revolution at this stage. But as we drove along the highway from Calais, you could see just along the highway every factory with red flags floating over the factories. Every factory was along the motorway. Finally, you see, God was on our side, Pablo. You see, that's why I always quote the Bible, you know. he remembered us. And we finally got some petrol, and we reached Paris. As it happened, we were staying in the Latin Quarter. I can't remember who put us up. I remember we were staying in the place with a Mexican comrade, but I can't remember much about that. But certainly, the moment you hit the streets, you walk around the streets, you could see that it was a revolution. There's no question about it. For example, you'd have a situation where somebody, some kid from some left-wing group would put a wall newspaper. All the walls were covered with newspapers. There wasn't a single wall that wasn't covered with posters, newspapers, slogans, drawings. There was revolutionary art. Very, very, very imaginative posters were produced. Mainly by the students. It's a marvelous thing. But they put a newspaper on the wall, some Maoist group or whatever, they stick a newspaper on the wall. And, you know, the communists got some difficulty sometimes selling the sources, getting something to buy the sources to pay, not in 68. In France, you just got to put a newspaper on the wall and you'd have 50 or 100 people gathering around, what is this saying? I said, what is he? I'm struggling to read it and so on. And then discussing and arguing and talking. Everywhere on the streets, on the street corners, in the bus stops, no longer talking about football and so on and so forth, the opium of the people. They're talking about politics. They were talking about the strike. They were talking about what de Gaulle was doing. And I'll tell you what de Gaulle was doing in a moment. Everyone was on the move, even the girls in the Folies Bergère. If you know, do you know what that is, Jacob? Yes? Well, you shouldn't. You're too young. Even the dancing girls then in the cabarets, the Folies Bergère, even they were on strike. I remember in one town, I can't remember which one it was, it might have been Nantes. I think it was Nantes. The footballers, you know, despite me speaking ill of the footballers, I better retract that statement. The footballers seized the football ground and hauled up a red flag over the football pitch. This is typical of the Midwest. It was an electric move. Is difficult for me to convey to you. And of course the students. not just the students. I'll tell you, the most unlikely case that I remember, that unlikely group of people that were caught up in the strike, was the Cannes Film Festival. I think it's pronounced Cannes, isn't it? The Cannes Film Festival, you know that. At that time, it was Brigitte Bardot and things like that, you know. Stars and starlets and champagne parties and stuff like this. The Cannes jury went on strike and they had to stop the festival. They had to cancel the Cannes Film Festival because they went on strike. You didn't know that, did you, Steve? Oh, you haven't read my article, you scoundrel. You see, now he's exposed. It was everywhere, even business executives. I don't know what the hell they were doing, but even they occupied the business executives' building. I don't know why. It was an enormous fever. Every single university was occupied, and every school was occupied. The lycée participated. Young school students, like Jacob and many others, participated in the movement actively. It was a marvelous thing. The whole of society, it was as if they'd woken up from sleep, risen up and stood on their feet and looked around and said, here we are, the French people. It was a marvelous thing. I went to, as I said, I won't waste time with personal reminiscences. I think I'll write an article about it. It might be of a certain interest. But I went to the Sorbonne to try to establish contacts with the students. It was impossible to contact the workers at that time because the bureaucracy made damn sure that all the factory gates, they were occupied, but they were locked. And the most you could do is just maybe speak to the workers through the gates or through the bars. You couldn't get close to them. Oh, I forgot to mention. Yes, that's right. Near where I was staying in the Latin Quarter, the scientists occupied an observatory. You know, it's astonishing. They occupied the observatory. And I remember we're walking along the street and there was buildings, obviously a public building. I said to the Mexican comrade, I said, what building is that? He said, oh, that's a labor exchange. Now, just imagine that in France in 68, the type of civil servant that'd be working in a labor exchange, one would have thought was very conservative. The whole building was plastered with union posters. CFDT, actually. Join the CFDT, you would expect it to be the CFDT. Astonishing situation. That's what I just told you is less than 1% of 1% of what actually took place. Incidentally, here's an interesting point. You see, we have the sectarians who always argue, oh no, well, the Stalinist account of revolutionary and so, which is, it is true that the leaders of the Communist Party paid a counter revolutionary vote. And yet, you see, there is a law which Ted Grant worked out. It's a marvelous, profound sociological law, which knows no exceptions in history. There's no exceptions to this. It's an absolute, as a law of physics, that when the working class begins to move, which is not every day, of course, they always, in the first instance, express themselves through the existing official mass organizations of the working class. Doesn't matter how bureaucratic they are or how right-wing, there doesn't make any difference. It's an absolute law. Now, what was the case in France in 1968? The Socialist Party was very small at that time. They had about 4%. And by the way, the sects were saying, oh, it's going to disappear. Ted Grant, I remember. Ted was in Paris also with me at the time. I discussed this with him. He said, no. Even though the French Socialist Party's got 4%, they can recover. And by God, they did recover. And they overtook the Communist Party in the end. So Ted was shown to be correct on that. But at that time, the Communist Party had a crushing majority. They were the main workers' party, without any argument about it. Now, I remember I bought a copy of L'Humanité. Unfortunately, I've lost all this material. I had material from 68, but I've travelled so much that I lost a lot of it, and unfortunately, now I don't think I've got any of it. But I did have that copy of L'Humanité, which is the daily paper of the Communist Party. And on the front page, there was an article, which was quite astounding, that this must have been towards the 20th of May. I can't remember the exact dates when I was there. It was towards the end. It took me some time to get sorted in order to go across. It must have been about the 20th. So it was about a couple of weeks after the strike had started, or less than a couple of weeks after the strike started. And on the front page, there was an article which stated that the Communist Party had set up, just think of this, they'd set up 81 new branches in the Paris region alone in 2 weeks. They ran out of membership cards. They didn't have enough membership cards for people applying to join the party. Because, of course, the workers, the masses that have recently aroused a political life, you think they're going to study the history of the Communist Party and Stalinism and so on? All they know is, this is our party, this is the Workers' Party, this is the Communist Party, I'm a communist, I want revolution like in Russia. That's what they thought. There's enormous about, I've already mentioned the trade unions grew tremendously. There was a similar process among the students. Now, they make a lot of nonsense is talked about the anarchists. I'll deal with the anarchists in a moment. It's quite interesting. This chap, Daniel Cohn-Bendit, I don't know if you've ever heard of him. Daniel Cohn-Bendit? Cohn-Bendit? At that time, everybody knew him, you know. Danny the Red, he was called. That's right. Danny the Red, he was nicknamed in Britain. They always pick up one chap that's supposed to be the key agitator. That's their mentality. He's responsible for all this, all our problems, you know. A bit like Bin Laden, I suppose. He was like that. You know, he was demonized. Danny the Red. Well, of course, that is nonsense. Daniel Cohn-Bendit was a minor figure in point of fact. He was an accidental figure to be thrown up by the movement. Didn't have any real mass base, but he was an anarchist. And many of the students had anarchist tendencies, which I suppose is understandable. In a sense, I suppose there's something healthy about it, but they were reacting against the bureaucracy of the Stalinists, the suffocating control of the trade union leaders and so on. It's understandable in that sense. It's still wrong, and I'll give you some amusing examples from my own experience about this. But even in the students, the official organization of the students, I think it was the FAN, no? Fédération d'étudiants nationale, or quelque chose comme ça. I think it was the FAN. Which was originally quite a big organization, but it had fallen down to about from about a million to about maybe 50,000 at most. And the anarchists and the sectors say, oh, it's finished, it's bureaucrat. But no, not a bit of it. The FAN began to become active in attacking the reforms and so on. They picked up quite a lot of support. They began to play quite a significant role. But just a couple of my own observations. At this point, I will give some of my own experiences because they reveal certain things. Now, I went to the Sorbonne looking for the student movement. But when I got there, it was quite an interesting sight. Have you been to the Sorbonne? You went to that? No. It's very impressive. Old building, it must be what? 16th century, something like that? 17th century, I can't remember. Very impressive. Huge courtyard, you know, with these ancient monuments and ancient colonnades and so on. The same kind of spirit that you breathe in Oxford and Cambridge and other places like that. But it was all occupied. And there were red flags hanging from all the pillars and the statues of Richelieu and so on, and the posters, revolutionary posters and so on. And of course, all the groups, which were quite small at that time, all the left groups, had their own stalls like this, all around the central courtyard. And at that time they had monthly papers, little monthly papers. And I went table by table, I looked at every single newspaper. These papers, of course, being monthlies, they were printed, they were produced before the strike started. In every single case on the front page, you had Vietnam, Cuba, Che Guevara, Mao Zedong, Fidel Castro, anything and everything except the French working class. Not a single word about the problems of the workers or anything, because it didn't enter their heads, the same as it doesn't enter their heads now. But I think the only group that did have stuff about the working class, it was a group, I think it used to be called Vau Ouvrière, I think it's now called Lutte Ouvrière, I believe. They'd be traditionally a syndicalist group. But the others were all 1,000 miles away. They didn't see the processes taking place in the working class in their own. That was one point. Now, we at one stage, we couldn't contact directly with the workers. We bought a little pamphlet with our program, which was that this was a revolution, that we're in favor of workers' power, and that the way forward would be for the workers in the occupied factories to elect committees, democratically elected committees, Soviets, if you like, that they in turn should link up on a city basis and on a district basis and a regional basis, and finally elect delegates to a national labor convention, a national convention of the working class, which would in effect be an alternative government. That was our program that we put forward. With other demands also. Now, we attended a meeting. There were student solidarity committees set up. They did good work. I mean, it was very good that the students attempted to fraternize with the workers and arrange collections of money and so on. This was good. By the way, the women played a colossal role in the strike, in the committees and so on, raising money and other solidarity activities. Very important role, as always happens. But I attended this meeting with this Scottish comrade who was sitting in the corner. My French was quite good at that time. It's a bit crusty since then, but it was quite good at the time. So I was listening to what they were saying. At this late stage of the strike, the government was beginning to react. The government was beginning to react. De Gaulle had gone to Germany. He'd actually, to show that he saw his contempt for the strike, he'd actually gone to Romania to a visit to the so-called communist Ceausescu, who welcomed him with open arms. He went on a state visit. Yes, his confidence didn't last for long. He got a few phone calls from Paris. He had to cut his trip short and gallop back. And according to all the observers, he was completely demoralized. Absolutely demoralized. I'll deal with that in a moment. But he was contemplating taking action against the strikers. He obviously asked General Massieu, what's the score with the army? Can we use the army? And Massieu must have told him, no deal, impossible. The Times newspaper sent their correspondent to Germany at that time. And the correspondent, I remember well, he interviewed the soldiers, the French soldiers who were in Germany. And the question was, would you be prepared to fire on the French workers? And the answer, the unanimous answer was, no way. I'm the son of the worker, how can I fire on my own class? And so on. There were even soldiers' committees began to be set up. Massieu said, no. Not possible. The police unions were on strike by this stage, or at least refusing to. Even the intelligence service was refusing to. This emerged. Pompidou admitted this. The intelligence service was refusing to pass information about student leaders. I think they were demanding pay. It became contagious, you know. But you see, when the rot reaches the security service, then the state is in trouble. But they were trying to send that there was a particular part of the French police, the CRS, who were thugs, armed police, who were really vicious, brutal. But even they were demanding danger money because ordinary Parisians were throwing flower pots at them, you know, and hundreds of them ended up in hospital, as a matter of fact. So they were demanding danger money. But towards the end of the strike, the government was beginning to get its nerves back. Only because of the conduct of the trade union and communist leaders, so-called communist leaders, saving the position for them. Actually, at the beginning of the strike, this is in one of de Gaulle's, one of his biographers states this fact, sympathetic biographer, says at the beginning, he turned to one of his ministers and he said, don't worry, Flocan, I think that was his name, don't worry, Flocan, the communists will keep them under control, I'm off to Romania. But he actually said that. The communists will keep them under control. They didn't keep them under control. That's the problem. And de Gaulle was panicking. He was panicking to the extent that when he came back from Romania, the American ambassador, I think he was a man called Carlucci, who subsequently went to Portugal. He was there during the Portuguese Revolution. Frank Carlucci, who wrote his memoirs. He called de Gaulle to the American embassy. He was obviously worried, or maybe he went to the palace. I don't know. He said, what's happening? What's happening in France? And you know how what de Gaulle replied? He said, the game's up. The game's up. Everything is lost. And in a few days, the communists will be in power. De Gaulle said that. That shows the real situation. But by this late stage, anyway, they were trying to get some kind of semblance of order. And they were also trying some selective repression. They were sending police against some of the pickets. So to come back to this discussion with the students, they were gathered around the table, it was all very anarchic. And they were arguing, they wanted to produce a leaflet, and it was a terrible leaflet, I wish I'd kept a copy. But it was full of slang, you know, argo, you know, abali fleek, and all sorts of insults, and down with the cops, and this, that, and the other, and the only good cop is a dead one, and this kind of language, you know. Anyway, I sat in the corner quietly. Actually, they looked around, and they said, do the English comrades want to say, well, I was sorry to tell them that there wasn't any English comrades there, actually. Only one Scotsman and one Welshman, but I didn't think it was the appropriate time to clarify these issues, you know. So he said, do the English comrades want to speak? I said, we're not elected by anybody, we don't represent any. Oh, no, that doesn't matter, anyone can speak here, this is typical, anyone can speak here. I said, so I came to the table, I said, do you want my opinion of this leaflet? He said, yes, give us your opinion. I said, I think it's... tried to be polite. I said, I think it's very abstract. Says, yes. I said, what would you put in it? I says, look, the concrete reality is that the police are attacking, they're beating up workers on the picket lines. Surely the workers must defend themselves. And therefore we should put forward the idea of a workers' defence force to defend the picket line, even to arm the picket line if necessary, to defend ourselves against aggression. Yes, they were all nodding in agreement. I says, do you agree with this? Says, yes. Well, are you going to put it in the leaflet? No, we can't put that in the leaflet. I says, why not? He says, we can't tell the workers what to do. We can't tell the workers what to do. I said, comrades, it's not a question of telling the workers what to do. Don't tell the workers what to do, of course. I said, but look, you've been very good in the strike, you've been acting in solidarity, and you've it's like Venezuela, isn't it? You heard this before in Venezuela, Pablo, the argument about the Hands of Venezuela campaign. Can't tell the Venezuelan people what to do. I said, it's not a question of telling people what to do. I said, but we've been active in solidarity. We've done all the work. The workers respect you. You've got good relations with the workers. Surely you have a right to put a point of view, to put forward an opinion which the workers can accept or reject. You can't force them to accept it. Just for them to be aware you're making this proposal, that's all. I don't think any worker would object to that. Are you going to put it in? No. Can't tell the workers what to do. And so while we were in the middle of this argument, a group of workers came into the room from a factory, and nearby factory. They were young workers, electricians, I think. And a furious discussion broke out between the workers and this anarchist leader, because the anarchists do have leaders, by the way. How Bukharin defined anarchism, Pablo? You know Bukharin's definition of anarchism? It's quite amusing. His anarchism has got two rules. The first rule is, you must not form a political party. The second rule is, nobody must obey the first rule. Think about it. So anyway, there were an argument. The young workers, I understood what they were saying. The young workers were very frustrated. They said, look, we young workers, we're in favour of the revolution. We agree with you. Said, but unfortunately, most of the people in our factory are older workers, and they don't understand what we're saying when we talk about revolution. They don't understand this, you know. What we really need is an organisation that can explain the ideas and so on. No. He said, no leaders. The student said. I said, excuse me, I think what the comrade is trying to say, what the working class needs is a revolutionary party with revolutionary leadership and a program that could help us to explain to the rest of the class. Yes, that's what we want, the workers. No leaders. And that's how it was left. I think that little incident, of course, I'm not saying that this group of students are very honest people, they were doing their best, they were a bit confused and so on. But I'm not saying that they could have made a fundamental difference. But what a tragedy, because that was the real situation in France at that time. I repeat, power was in the hands of the working class. There's no argument about that. And the people who saved the situation in France was not the police, it was not the army. That's nonsense. It's like, that's what the communist leaders were saying. Oh no, comrades, no, if we were to try to take power, there would have been streets running with blood and civil war and violence. That's complete nonsense. Complete nonsense. The committees of soldiers are passing resolutions saying, no, 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 under no circumstances will we fire against workers and so on. Even the police union in Paris passed a resolution to that effect, that we refuse to be used against the workers in struggle. The police actually wrote, it's quite comic, I think it was even the riot police, passed a resolution saying that by its actions, because the government were making concessions, they were backpedaling to try and calm things down, by its actions, the government shows that the students were right. And therefore, we don't understand why this couldn't have been done earlier and avoided all this violence that has taken place. The police passed that resolution. So if the soldiers and the police and even the intelligence service don't tell me that there would have been a serious possibility of violence and civil war. Power was in the hands of the workers. There's no argument about it. Unfortunately, what was the problem? The problem was leadership, or the absence of leadership. The so-called communists and the leaders of the French Communist Party and the CGT had not the slightest intention, the slightest perspective of socialism or taking power under any circumstances. They wanted to end this strike as quickly as possible when de Gaulle was on his last legs, when he was tumbling. They held out a hand. They offered to negotiate precisely at the moment when he was, even his biographers stated, Pompidou in his memoirs, George Pompidou says that de Gaulle was utterly demoralized, didn't know what to do. And at that moment, the trade union leaders offered, let's negotiate, we must find a negotiated settlement for this problem. Now you see, when the ruling class, you must understand, when the ruling class is faced with losing everything, they will always be prepared to give something, some concessions, always. Big concessions. They gave big concessions. They offered the trade union leaders things which they weren't even contemplating asking for, like a 35% increase in the minimum wage, increased pensions, anything you want. Only one condition, please leave the factories. Leave our factories. Go home. Calm down. We'll give you anything you want. Of course, it's very easy for the bosses to give wage increases with the left hand, and a few months later they will take it back with the right hand through inflation, rising prices, taxes, or whatever. That's nothing easier than that. But the whole thing was to get the workers out of the factories. Now, again, if I may be permitted to quote from my own experience, I can't remember the date, it may be in the 23rd or 24th of May. You see how quickly the events move in the revolution. I was in a bar, not getting drunk. I might add, Seamus is looking at me very, very suspiciously. This was at midday, I think I might have been having a sandwich and a coffee or something. But the bar was full of workers, actually, ordinary people, looking at the television. On the television screen, where the television camera was inside the gigantic Reynolds plant, I think it was inside this gigantic factory, I think it was 5,000 workers. I've never seen such a thing. The whole factory was full of workers. There was no room to move. They were sitting on the gantries and cranes. An amazing sight. Listening to everywhere, and George Segui, the leader of the CGT, who was just come back from negotiating with the government, came with the proposals, and you never heard such proposals. He was quite smart. I was struck how clever this man was. He didn't make a long speech. He went straight to the point. Comrades, the employers and the government and the unions have reached agreement. The boo started already. And he immediately says, and they're offering this. 35% increase in the minimum wage, this, that, and the other. Less hours of work, more holidays, more pensions. As he was speaking, so the shouting started at the beginning. The moment he said we reached an agreement with him, the shouting started, and the whistle started. And then a roar went up. I'll never forget. It came across loud and clear on the television. The roar went up. Gouvernement populaire, gouvernement populaire. People's government, we don't want a wage increase. We want power, that's what they were saying. Segui couldn't couldn't finish his speech. Now this is interesting, and here again I will give a personal reminiscence, showing the sheer stupidity, ignorance, crass ignorance and stupidity of the ultra-left sects, always, at all times. There were many left-wing groups in France, called themselves Trotskyists. The most important one was probably the Unified Secretariat of the Fourth International, led by Ernest Mandel. By the way, Ernest Mandel, supposed to be a theatrician, was in London at the beginning of May. He gave a speech in London. Our communists, I wasn't there myself, but the communists told me what happened. But at this meeting, he spoke for an hour and talked about Vietnam, Middle East,
Che Guevara,
gay lib, women's lib, you mention it. Not a single word about the French Guiana. So one of our comrades asked a question. Comrade Mandel, you've spoken for 1 hour. You have not mentioned the French working class once. You know what his reply was? He said, you can forget about the French working class for the next 20 years. They're bourgeoisified, they're Americanized. This is at the beginning of May, he said this. Now, I was in, outside the mass meeting. I can't remember what the mass meeting was. It was a big meeting. And, of course, the groups were selling their papers and so on. And one of them, the Mandelite, was distributing, from the JCR, Jeunesse Communiste Revolutionnaire, was distributing a leaflet. I wish I lost the damn leaflet. I have the leaflet. I've lost it. I remember it now. I remember it as if it's before me, as if it's in my hand. It was jammed, it was printed, one sheet. It was packed with very small print, very abstract, typical product of academic Marxists, you know. Very abstract, nothing concrete about it, no concrete slogans to help the workers to fight. Oh, no. It was a big, long thing. And you know what the basis of it was? The basic idea of this leaflet was explaining to the French workers that they were politically backward, okay? They were not revolutionary, okay? And that without them, without the JCR, they were not capable of arriving at a level of consciousness higher than a trade union, an economic level, trade union level. In other words, wages. And they quoted Lenin. Now, in my house, in East Ham, if you care to visit me one day, I've got a library of Marxist books in which I have the complete works of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. I've read, I think, most of them. But they're about, 45 volumes, I think, in English. In Russian, there's somewhat more. 45 volumes, thick volumes. And of all the 45 volumes of Lenin's works, these guys, and it's the same thing now, they only know one quote. They only ever repeat one quote, taken from What Is to Be Done, 1902, where Lenin made a mistake. He made a mistake, comrades. He actually did write that in What Is to Be Done. That left to themselves, he says, the working class will only ever acquire a trade union consciousness, an economic consciousness. It was a mistake. Lenin admitted that it was a mistake subsequently. He never repeated it, but never repeated that. And he corrected it subsequently. He says, oh, I made a mistake. It was an polemical exaggeration. It was in a polemic with the economist trend at that time. He made a mistake, which is a palpable mistake. It's a ridiculous mistake. To look no further, the Chartists in Britain were a political or revolutionary organization, even, without the participation of Marxists. In 1936 in Barcelona, the workers didn't require educated academic Marxists to seize power, in effect. Unfortunately, the anarchists messed it up. That's a different question. It's all nonsense. Yeah, this is comical. All of Lenin's works, they have to, and in what a situation, where 10 million French workers have occupied the factories and they're only capable of having an economic consciousness. And the reverse was the truth. The reverse was the truth. Here is Segi, supposedly a communist, supposedly an educated Marxist, saying, no, what do you want, what do you really want, girls and boys, is wage increases, right? What you really want is the reduction of hours. And we're shouted down. We don't want this. Gouvernement populaire. So where's the relevance of this nonsense, this ridiculous crap that is constantly being churned out by these so-called Marxists. It makes me indignant even to think of it. No, the problem was the French workers did have a revolutionary consciousness. They did take power. What more can you ask I ask you, what more could you ask of the French workers more than what they did? The problem was not the workers, the problem was the leadership. It was the Stalinist leadership that betrayed the French Revolution of 1968 and handed power back to the capitalists, back to De Gaulle, in effect. In exchange for elections, De Gaulle lifted his little finger, take these wage increases, persuade the workers to get out of the factories and we'll call elections. They thought they were going to win. They did not win. The workers punished them. They were defeated. De Gaulle was re-elected. The right wing was re-elected. And even within the working class, the communists lost a lot. Within 10 years or so, the CP had lost its hold over the workers. The Socialist Party, which at least in words was on the left, in words, I'm not saying not in practice, but in words they stood for more left than thought. The CFDT even made big inroads into the trade unions. Nowadays, the Communist Party in France is a shadow of its former self. And that goes back to 1968. Now, I could go on, but I better not. It's a question of time. Einstein says that time is relative, but I have reason to believe otherwise. For our purposes, anyway. It's absolute. So, just one final remark. You see, now, the final remark is this. Why should we be sitting here this afternoon, beautiful sunny day like this, and talking about events that occurred 40 years ago? What relevance does this have? Now, the answer I can give you, quite a good answer, is from an American philosopher, a man called George Santayana, who said the following: he who does not learn from history will forever be doomed to repeat it. Now, we have a duty to history, if you like. We have a duty to our class to learn the lessons, not just of 1968, but every other revolution, successful, both the successes and the failures. We must learn in the same way that the generals in the military academy study very carefully the wars of the past in order to prepare for the future wars. Because you see, and I will finish on this point, comrades and friends, May 1968, to me, is not ancient history. I know there's a lot of people, not the sort of people I like to mix with. These old, grey, pot-bellied old gentlemen who talk about 1968. Oh, what a wonderful dream we had. Oh, it was marvellous, you know. Nostalgic nonsense. Ah, of course, then today they're complete reactionary. You know, they cut their hair. They had long hair at the time and probably flowers in it as well. Open-toed sandals, and they had a dream, you see. They were dreaming right enough. That I can confirm. You see, they understood nothing. They understood nothing then, and they understand even less now. Of course, they're dressed in banker's suits. And they talk about it. Yes, they'll be a bit nostalgic to it. They'll wipe a tear from their eye when they think about their misspent youth, their lost youth, you know. Then they'll go back to looking at their fat bank accounts, and then they'll warn their kids, their children, their daughters, don't you get involved in revolutionary politics. It's all nonsense, you know. It all ends in tears. Let me just finish on this note. May 1968 in France is not history. What I've been talking about here is not history. What I'm talking about is the present, and above all, it's the future that I'm talking about. There will be other May 68s. In France, quite possible. In Italy, almost certainly. And even in Britain, yes, you better believe it. Austria, you know, in all countries. The conditions are being prepared. And what we must do is also to prepare for that, to prepare ourselves for the great events that come, in order that history will not repeat itself. in order that the next time that the working class moves in a decisive way, there will be people, there will be individuals, there will be an organisation that is capable of providing what was missing in 60. That is to say, the vital ingredient of leadership.
Yes.
Of leadership. To quote the what Trotsky once said, what somebody asked him, what is necessary to make a revolution? He says, you want to know the answer to that? There are three things that are necessary. The party, and once again, the party. That is what is required. This is what is required. But of course, the party starts with us. It starts with you. And it starts, above all, with a thorough understanding of the processes of history and our place in history. And on that basis, we will go forward. There will be future movements of the class, which will lead, sooner or later, to a decisive victory, whether it's in Venezuela, in Argentina, in Spain, in Italy, in France, even in Britain. One decisive victory of the working class will be sufficient to start an irreversible process in the direction of the world socialist revolution.